Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, griefsters. Hope you're having an okay week. It's been such a long time since I said that. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for coming back. I know I have been away for quite a while, probably one of the longest times I've been away. One of the reasons I've been away, you know, other than just craziness of life, is if you've been listening for a while, you know I have been boring you for some time. I've been writing a book based on things I've learned from the podcast. The book is finally finished. It is coming out next year. It is called You Are Not Alone. I will be probably banging on about it quite a bit. Apologies already. If you already skipped the intro, you never hear this anyway, so that's fine. But if you're one of my wonderful, wonderful griefsters that takes the time to listen, you know who you are. Thank you. You can already pre-order it, but I will do more of a shout when you can like really pre-order it. I don't know, but you can you can already do it if you're keen. It's coming out in January next year officially. Now that has been decided. It has been quite difficult writing that book in a pandemic, but also wonderful in the strange way that talking about grief and writing about it is both those things. So I will be shouting about that as we go on. And welcome to season 9. I cannot believe we're here, but we are, and I am so glad that we're still here, still talking about grief, still being okay with talking about grief and opening up that space so that other people can learn with us how to talk about it. Thank you for listening. This is Griefcast. This week, I'm talking to an incredible person. He's an actor, he's a writer, he is an activist. He did appear last year on Strictly as well. It is the incredible Greg Wise. You'll know Greg. Of course you'll know him. He's done a bazillion things, including playing Willoughby in Sense and Sensibility. If you know my other passion is doing a Jane Austen themed improv show called Ostentatious, so I was quite impressed that I didn't just talk about that for an hour. He wrote a beautiful, beautiful book called Not That Kind of Love, about caring for his sister who died of cancer. And that is who we began our conversation talking about, Claire. So who are we remembering today?
We are remembering my sister, Claire.
Claire
is the reason that my life has taken the shape it has for the last, 6 years now. Because I've become, I don't know if you want to call it campaigner, is it a campaigner? I've understood, and my sister's early tragic death brought everything into such a sharp focus for me. A lot of things that I'd always been mulling and thinking about, and actually an awful lot of my time now is spent talking about death and grief and getting oneself together and getting a will. sorting out your death box, yeah. all of this stuff, because you can't live properly without a relationship with death. It's that simple. It's that clear. And unfortunately, most of us are sort of adolescent about it all, thinking, actually, it will never happen to me.
Yeah.
It's the only thing we know that's going to happen, isn't it, really?
Yeah, guaranteed.
And I had the privilege of being able to be my sister's full-time carer for the last few months of her life, just before she died when she was 51. And that has coloured everything that's happened since.
So what did Claire die of?
She had bone cancer. She started with breast cancer, allegedly was in remission. I don't think she ever was. Mm. And then it became a bone cancer, which you don't get better from. So I was with her for the last 3 months, living with her,
wow.
just the two of us together in her space.
Oh, my goodness. That is, as you said, it is a privilege to help someone like that, as I know from my own experience and from speaking to other people, but it is a huge thing to deal with as well. And I think it's incredible that you have changed your life and you are, as you know, able to talk about it. And I'm definitely in the campaign of becoming an activist of talking about this stuff. Mm. I think once you realise, it's like once you've swallowed the pill of like, oh, we should just talk about this. It's like, you can't stop, can you? Because you're like, guys, it's so easy. We could just talk about it and we could make such a difference.
Yeah, you have to be careful not to become evangelical about it. And of course, you know, again, we can open up, we could talk about this for days because do you use the D word?
Yeah.
Past. They've passed. They're sleeping, whatever else. But I think we try and inure ourselves a lot of the time in our lives from any form of stuff either too extreme in the positive or too extreme in what's perceived as the negative. We want to try and keep ourselves on a reasonably narrow bandwidth. But one of the things, because the universe is balanced, there was an extraordinary privilege with my sister being able to be there as her carer, and that was absolutely balanced by the trauma of being there with my sister. And we know this as parents. We know that love we feel for our offspring is balanced by the rage, the resentment,
the agony, the
sleeplessness,
torture,
the agony, all of that. And it has to be. It has to be. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And it's, I think it was me being able to take myself to a place that is quite rare for people to go to realise, actually, then the scales do fall away. Mm. And and at least I think I got a sense of an understanding of a clarity, because I think an awful lot of noise comes into most of our lives most of the time that makes it quite hard for us to find a simplicity. And one of the things about terminal illness, and I think about grief, is there's a simplicity that is brought with it, because you can only be where you are, sitting within your grief. You can only be sitting within your grief. And that's why I think it can be a fantastically positive thing.
Yeah, and we've talked about that a lot on the show, of it's so multifaceted. And I think that's also what people find hard who haven't been through the experience. If, like, because they fear it so much, they just think, oh, it just looks awful and lots of crying. Like, I just don't want to open that door. It looks really awful. And there is a lot of crying. Nobody would, you know, deny that. But like you said, there's positives. There's truth. And I think that's what's very hard to explain when you haven't experienced it. A bit, you know, similar to the truth of having children, of like how simultaneously brilliant and awful it is at exactly the same second. Like, oh God, I can't believe how tired I am, but also I can't believe how much I love you, but also my God, please everyone stop shouting. And grief, and I know that can be frustrating for people who haven't had children, but grief is a very similar kind of extreme sport in that, you know, you realize how much you love someone, you realize how important they are, you realize, like you said, the simplicity of life. All that matters is, does this person love you? Do they know that you love them? Have you said what you needed to say? Like, that's really what it comes down to, mixed in with absolute agony and pain. Were you, what was your attitude like before you faced it? Like, were you someone who was like, you know, most people were like, oh yeah, it won't happen to me. And then when Claire's diagnosis happened, was that the process of like, oh shit, I have to deal with this?
No, I was, again, fortunate that my best chum died when we were 25.
Oh gosh.
Suddenly. And that, again, the tragedy of that really helped clarify an awful lot of things about how to live, about ambition.
Mm.
He and I were waterfall climbers and kind of extreme mountaineers and various things, and he pushed things to the very limit and was drowned.
Oh gosh.
And that made me take myself away from everything and reassess what everything's all about, because at that point in our lives we're still immortal.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, in our early mid-20s, we are absolutely immortal. And no, there is mortality. And how does one deal with the idea of mortality at the outset of an adult life?
Mm.
Because I was at drama school till I was 25. And he died just after I became a professional actor. So just reassessing all of that, which was bouncing around anyway, but was brought into sharp focus by that. And the grief of his death made me take myself away as far as I could and went to Australia. And again, it's a very interesting thing about grief, because he died when I was doing a play at Nottingham Theatre, Nottingham Playhouse. It was a very dark play, very messed up play, so I was in a strange zone anyway, but I couldn't grieve. Whether there was a little bit of me saying, actually, I've still got 3 weeks of this run to do, and
I owe
it to everything to carry on. But I couldn't grieve afterwards either, and I took myself away as far as possible and went to Australia. And I'd been at school in Australia for a while, and I had a sort of second family out there, and retired as an actor a year in.
Wow.
And just said, I have to go, I have to leave, I just got to get myself sorted out. And it was months later, driving up through the Red Centre, where the road doesn't bend for hours, where it's just flat and baked, and there's no sense of a human scale, there's no sense of any scale of speed. And it was that moment that allowed me to reassess what all of this meant, where I found myself fitting within a landscape.
Wow.
And I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. And it was maybe the perspective of going to the other side of the world, or realizing that I'm utterly insignificant in this enormous landscape. I don't know what it was, but that's the other thing that's very important when looking at grief, is that it doesn't have a pattern.
No.
That it's not prescribed, that you hear a piece of news and you immediately start grieving and you burst into tears and you don't know what to do with yourself. Mm. No. So we, I think, have a tendency to judge ourselves in the moment as well, or judge other people for not grieving properly or not grieving at all. But knowing that with the death of my friend Simon, it took me months to get to a space where I was able to start to grieve properly. And I think that's very important for all of us to bear in mind, that there is no grief roadmap.
I think a lot of us have heard of the idea that the grieving starts as soon as you hear a diagnosis. Like, I think a lot of people are familiar with that. And I think what's interesting what you're talking about is the different types of death, you know, the different types of life and death. And I know with a terminal diagnosis, you know, often, like, once you hear that, oh, it's terminal, people begin to start the grieving process, which is a sort of hard thing to explain. But I think what we don't talk enough about, which is what I think you're referring to, is shock. You know, when somebody young dies, or when something happens out of the blue, or a tragic accident, the shock that you are in for months, if not years. And my dad died of cancer, diagnosis very quickly, when I was 15. And I was in shock for years. But if you'd said that to me, I would have been like, oh no, there's, you know, I have cried or I've done this. But at the back of my head was just like, what? What just happened? What just happened? So I completely can relate to that idea of like needing to be so far away from that event and that person and that place. And like you said, just you and the landscape of being like, oh, now it's quiet enough for me to hear those thoughts. Because I think so much of the beginning of grief is just what do you mean they've died? Like, what? And if someone's been ill for a long time, that's a very different feeling, because I think the shock lives with you for a long time. You know, you're like, oh my goodness, they're ill, they've got cancer, and you know, they have. But even then, when they die, it's still a shock. You know, you're still dealing with, but like, where they gone.
But then we also have to deal in that with pre-grief. And that was a thing that was very clear when I was with my sister, thinking, don't start grieving now. She's still here. I still have a role to play. Mm-hmm. We still have the relationship. We still have the day to day. It's really complicated.
Yeah, it is.
It's really complicated. And realizing as well that in a lot of the time, it's dealing with other people's neurosis about death.
Yeah.
And realizing that I was having to spend an awful lot of time talking her mates down.
Yeah. God. Also, if you're someone who can talk about grief and can hold that space, I think for other people who can't, you become like a magnet, because that's why they can come to you and be talked down, because you're someone who's like, yeah, I'm facing it. I'm looking at it really close and I can see this person's going to die. And for the people who can't, they're like, oh my God, they seem to know what's happening. And then you, like you said, you end up like managing fires, be like, okay, is she? Yes, she's going to die. Why am I having to deal with this? Because, and it's often is the person at the center, the closest person to the person who's, you know, very ill or dying. And I think it comes back to the idea as well that grief is so unique, and grief is completely about you and that person's relationship. And so, of course, you know, each grief is different because each person's relationship is different. And, you know, a relationship with a very close friend when you're 25 is completely different to nursing a sister when you're much older, dying of an illness as opposed to an act. Like, all of these things make such a big difference to the grief that you're feeling. And the pre-grief, as you're talking about, or anticipatory grief, I think it's also sometimes called. I think we have to allow ourselves that, because even though they are still here, and it makes perfect logical sense for your brain to start going, I'm already thinking ahead. I'm already thinking of when you're going to... Because you can't help it as a human, be like, oh, well, when they die, what will we do with this and what we do with it? And you feel so guilty for that. But actually, I think it's a very logical reaction. It doesn't mean you don't care or you want them to die. Like, you never want these things. Your brain is just doing that annoying logical brain thing of going, who will get that thing when they die? And you think, why are we having that thought? We don't need to think about that yet. But it's just your brain, like, trying to regain control in a sense of chaos.
Yeah, no, for sure. And another thing which I've found about a month ago, another one of my most glorious mates just got a 6-month diagnosis.
So sorry.
And he has always approached life in a, yeah, come on, it doesn't matter, woo-hoo. And of course he's approaching this in the same way. And thus one has to pattern one's response when with them, because you can't be there all sullen-faced. You can't be there...
The grief king is here. Hello.
The king of grief.
Yeah, I'm ready
because
to grieve
he's, Because, again, people approach their death how they've lived their lives.
Yes. Yeah.
Always. Yeah. And it's insane of us to think that it will happen. They'll suddenly have a Road to Damascus moment and you will have the big conversation. Nah. And so I'm having to be very careful with my friend now to mirror his state, which it may be denial, it may be whatever else, but it's how he's always lived. Life on the edge. Yeah. is how he's always lived. And he's going to approach death in exactly the same way. So, again, we have to be led by the person whose gig it is.
I completely agree. And I've said that before, like, you live as you die. My dad was a very big personality, very loud. You knew him. You knew he was in the room, is how I describe. Like, mm-hmm. that's, you just knew he was there. And he faced his death the same way. He was like, I'm not dying, it's fine. Right to the end. We need to sort this out. Get a pen, write this down. Next week, we're going to go to Boston. We're going to do this. And it was so hard. Obviously, because I was a teenager, so it was very difficult to be like, this man is insane. He's dying. Mm. But it's taken me years to go, that's how he dealt with it. And I think what you're saying is really honourable to your friend. And it's hard for people. It's really hard because if you're feeling sad or you're feeling that anticipatory grief, you want to take it to them and be like, I want to have the conversation with you. I want to sit down and have my moment. Yeah. And if they don't want it, you can't force it. You can't, like, they don't have to, they don't owe you it. Like, they're dying. They can do what the fuck they want. Yeah.
But my sister was terribly upset that she'd never had the closing of the circle conversation with my father.
Oh, yeah.
And as he was ill, and she and I were around and doing stuff with him, and we'd have conversations, I say, this is madness. Mm. Have you met our father? He won't have a proper conversation about anything with anyone. This is not going to happen. So she was very upset about that. Unfortunately, but a few short years later, she was going through the dying process, and the last bloody thing she wanted was anyone coming and wanting to close the circle on the relationship. You know,
classic.
It's classic. It's classic. You don't have these moments. These moments are for novels or for films.
I know, and I think if you're, it's that thing. Like, I've spoken to doctors and palliative care consultants, like our friend Dr. Catherine Mannix, before about death in films, and she was saying, oh, it's so frustrating, you know, they don't show it properly. And I was like, death in a story is to move a plot forward, to tell us something about a character. Mm-hmm. It's not to tell us anything about death. Normally it's like, oh, he really cried because he's really in love with her, right? That's what we need to know. And I think it's like we come to it in real life with the same expectation of like, oh, I'll get this moment. It's like, it's not, this isn't for narrative purposes. this is the end of your narrative. And yeah, you know, my dad was exactly the same, did not want to talk about it. And I was really upset for years and years and years. And it took, I mean, you know, like obviously being a teenager warps everything, but it took till getting into my 30s and going to therapy. And the first time I thought, oh, I wonder how he felt. Like, it just hadn't occurred to me because I was like, I didn't get my moment. And then you have to go, oh, I guess he was terrified and didn't want to talk about it. And I think, yeah, I can relate to your sister in that way of like, it doesn't stop, again, multifaceted grief. It doesn't stop you being upset about it. Like, you're allowed, you're upset that you don't get your closing the circle moment, but they don't have to give it to you because maybe they can't, you know, maybe they just can't.
No, absolutely. And again, we have to look at grief at this moment, which is of course mixed with a certain amount of, oh, thank God that's over.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. The relief. Yeah.
And to not give, again, it's so complicated, and we all always want to look at ways of being able to flagellate ourselves about not responding correctly and with as much humanity as we'd hoped. But the relief is intense.
Yeah.
When something like this has happened, when a terminal illness has played itself out, it's a whole other thing. And you are allowed to be thankful. And there is a certain amount of gratitude then mixed in with the grief as well, which is why, you know, grief is the most beautiful cleanser. It's the most glorious cleanser. If you don't get in the way, if you don't judge, if you accept that the grief you feel absolutely is equal to the love you felt. Mm. And it's one of the things I know that I was very aware of, I think probably from the time my mate was drowned right the way through, is that if you are not able to allow yourself to process physically, because grief starts at the knees and works its way up, and emotionally, you're going to get ill.
Yes, yep, yeah.
You are going to get ill. And don't judge it, don't apologise for it. If you suddenly start weeping in the frozen peas section of the supermarket, don't apologise for it. It's happened. Let it through.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So how long ago was it that Claire died? 6 years ago, you said?
She died in, September 2016.
And I was just thinking, because what you're saying, I completely agree with, like, you have to not judge it. You have to just let it be. But it's hard. Like, is there a way, did you feel like this at the beginning with Claire? Or do you think, like, 6 years on, you can go, right, I don't judge my grief days now, I just let them. Or from the beginning, were you, right, I'm not going to judge myself, I'm just going to let these feelings be what they are?
Oh, I had no judgment.
Wow.
Right from the start. I had no emotional energy left to judge myself.
Yeah.
That was the point. I was in a terrible, terrible, terrible state because of the chronic nature of the pressure. We were trapped together.
Yeah.
It was oddly a pre-echo of all the lockdown
that
we had a few years after that. We were unable to leave this space for literally 3 months, but I think the vestigial limb syndrome is still very apparent because a bit of you is amputated.
Yeah.
The hand of fate comes into you and just pulls out a great big lump of interior organs and flesh.
Yeah.
And you're left with this madly gaping hole.
Yeah.
And that hole then becomes a part of the shape of your being. And we are all beings shaped by our pasts, by our successes and our failures, by our triumphs, by our heartbreaks, by our all of these things. You know, I know people are listening to this and not looking at it, but you can see my fingers. I've broken everything. Everything's bent and deformed and scarred and doesn't work properly. And we're all full of holes in our being and holes in our heart from loss and from people leaving us emotionally or physically. And this is who we are. And I vibe on a lot about the kintsugi.
Oh, yes.
Of it all.
Yeah. Explain it just in case people don't know.
Okay, kintsugi is this beautiful oriental art of having this most perfect bowl, porcelain ceramic bowl, and then breaking it and then sticking it back together, often with seams of gold. And the idea is that perfection is sort of dead and not very beautiful. And it is in the repair and the celebration of the break and the repair which is where the beauty lies, and shows us that this piece is so valued that even when broken, we repaired it and we're still using it. And I think that I've been vibing on a lot about this recently, that we are the physical mammalian manifestations of kintsugi, and our beauty resides in our brokenness and repair. And grief is part of that. Grief is an absolute... Grief is the gold lacquer that joins all our bits together.
That's such a beautiful way of relating kintsugi to grief, because I really that really resonates with me of like the beauty of it, which I think is it's hard to explain to other people. Speaking as someone who does a grief podcast, of like quite why you want to talk about, why you want to stay in that space. I think some people, you know, they see it as morbid, they see it as like festering almost, you know, like sitting in it, rather than like this is kind of, I like you said earlier, it's evangelical, isn't it? Because once I kind of realized how not magical but kind of magical it was to know this and to see it, then you do want to tell everyone, almost like, don't be afraid, like, yes, it's awful, yes, it's terrible, yes, it's painful, yes, it's tragic, but this is life, this is what it all is. And like the phrase you use there of like someone cared enough to repair it, I think that's so much of grief, of like you really have to care about yourself to put yourself back together. And that's hard. And that's hard for some people. Mm-hmm. Some people really, really struggle with that. But we do have that gaping hole is so real. I mean, I remember feeling like the wind could literally rustle through me. That's what it felt like. Yeah, it was just like, how is that happening? Like, I'm so cold in the middle of my soul. And to be able to love yourself enough to go, I'm going to repair this and it's going to take so much time, but I'm just going to do it piece by piece is a really challenging thing. And I know, you know, I have a lot of listeners who are right at the beginning of this journey who, when you say, oh, it's a beautiful thing, and it's all truth, and they're like, what? Like, they're just in the snotting, crying bit, and they're like, this is awful. And it's hard to kind of, I feel like that's why it's important. Grief elders, as I sometimes call us, do talk about it, to be like waving flags of like, there is somewhere where it's not perfect. I'm not like joyful all the time, but equally I'm not weeping all the time. I'm okay.
But it's a process. We are going to be grief stricken again.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Possibly at any minute. Mm. We never know. So we can't sit on our high horse and go, yes, I know what we're going through, but it's going to get better. But again, just what I was thinking when you were talking about that grief can trap oneself. Mm. And it can also propel oneself. And I was just thinking, oh, actually, then it is about death, isn't it? One approaches death how one's lived life. Maybe one approaches grief the same way, that grief can be used as a way of trapping oneself in the moment of loss. Yeah. All I have is loss. That person... That thing was the only thing that gave me shape, was the only thing that made my life worthwhile, and being trapped there. Or allowing the grief, as we've talked about already, to filter through you and make connections and make you understand. And one of the things I know with my sister, and it's, I suppose, a slightly pejorative word to use, but I think I'm a better person for it.
Yeah.
For the process of caring for her and then understanding everything after she died, that I feel more capable and compassionate and kinder as a result of it. But you can get trapped in a cycle of grief, as you can get trapped in any cycle as a human being. But there is no statutory limit. You know, we're looking at the government guidelines for bereavement. Is it still 2 days?
I know. I mean, at least we're talking about it. I try and be positive. Like, at least there's even a policy. You know, when I was younger, there you know, people weren't even mentioning it. You know, it was just like, oh, somebody passed away, that's the end of it, I'm back at work. So at least it is in the conversation. But I say that a lot, like, it takes what it takes. And that's so annoying. Like, it's such an annoying when you are at the start and you're like, you know, I want to know, like, is this going to be 6 months or a year? And you're like, could be 20. Like, I'm still 20 plus years, still talking about it, still working through things. I'm okay. You know, not every day is spent weeping on my knees. But yeah, it's still, like you said, I'm still working through that process. And I think it's important, like you said, just to, the not judgment, I suppose, is a massive part of it. How have you felt? Because I know you've talked about Claire, you've written about her, you beautifully and brilliantly brought it up when you were on Strictly, which I thought was so incredible. I was like open mouth watching that. I watch Strictly a lot. It's my like go-to escapism. I love dancing so much. And often, you know, because it's a reality show, occasionally things are treated in a bit of a mawkish way, you know, like, and the music starts. And I thought the way you dealt with it was just, I was like, wow, because you did a disco piece celebrating her, you were talking about celebrating her life. But the way you spoke about Claire, you didn't ignore the death, which often happens when people, either it's like, oh, they died, it's very sad, or it's, yay, they lived, I'm not going to mention they died. It's like, woohoo. And I thought you married those two elements so beautifully, where you said, I cared for her, it was very tragic, this is awful, it's painful, and now I'm going to do a dance that's really, is a disco dance, which is, yeah. If you haven't seen disco, it can only be done with joy. Like, it's not something you could do with any sense of, like, it's not contemporary, put it that way. It's no catharsis to it. It's just like, woohoo! And I thought that was really amazing. But how was that for you, talking about it, maybe especially on Strictly, on such a public, broad sphere where perhaps you're not talking to people who are very sensitive to it? Do you know what I mean? How was that experience?
But that was why I was doing it. That was why I was doing it. I did it because of my sister, who was the disco diva, who was carried into the crematorium by her, my wife and her three closest girlfriends in a glitter ball coffin.
Wow. Oh, Claire, I love you. That's amazing.
To banging disco.
Oh, brilliant.
So she was the reason I did it. And I was very fortunate that they asked me, actually, I think before we started, but if in the second week I'd like to do my couple's choice and tell a story of why I was here. And it was such a, again, the P word, a privilege to be able to do that. But also, I was very clear that I didn't want to talk about people passing or whatever else. I wanted to say, use the C word, you know, cancer, death, trauma, grief, and then go into a wild and silly dance. And that's the point. That's the point. And the fact that it was live.
Yeah.
In front of, I don't know, 12 million people watching it. And I loved that this glitzy bit of, I think it's the only live program we've got true, left on the telly at the moment, kind of almost hijacked in a way.
Yeah.
And saying, yes, we are here to celebrate the possibilities of all these folk learning something new every week and exposing themselves and doing this. And I just want to tell you why I'm here, and it's, I'm here because of this. And it was so wonderful over the next week or two, members of the stage crew stopping me on the stair and going, I just want to thank you so much for that, because I lost my mum last year to COVID, or my dad died, or whatever else, and I haven't been, I haven't felt able to talk about it. And just to see you there doing it in this show of all shows, so that was great. That was great, because we all do an awful lot of public speaking and podcasting and writing stuff, and there's a sense that maybe not speaking to the converted, but
no, I was just about to say that phrase. You're talking to people who want to talk about death, like those you know, those my listeners, my guys, they're people who are like, yeah, sign me up, let's have a chat about death and say cancer. The people who watch Strictly, they're here. That's why I watch it. It's escapism. I'm watching for like nothing, and that's why I sat and was like, oh my god, he's gonna do it, he's actually gonna say she died of cancer, this is how I felt. And I was like, oh my god. And I felt like, not attention, but like a certain frisson of like, as if you were doing something quite edgy, which isn't that funny. Mm. As you said, happens to everybody. Not a single member of that crew or cast or celebrities would, you know, no one sat there who would be like, oh, I don't know what death is. Like, everyone's touched by it in some form or other, or different scale. And it felt almost slightly, not dangerous, but like, wow, he's really going there. And that reminded me, again, as someone who often speaks to people who are happy to talk about it, and you almost get a bit blinkered, don't you? Like, yeah, everyone talks about death. And then you think, actually, no, not everyone does. Like, and I was so impressed and so pleased that someone was doing it so publicly and not hiding behind any sense of like decorum, I suppose, like old fashioned, like I'm gonna behave the way you expect me to. I'm going to look sad. I'm going to do a sad waltz. There's going to be a photo where we all look sad, and then no one's going to mention it again, because that's what the expected response. So yeah, I thought you were really brave. Was it scary to kind of go, I am going to put my grief on that space?
Look, it's scary going on a fucking dance show in front of 12 million people anyway.
Yeah, true, sorry.
A little bit...
Yeah, yeah, extra, and a little bit of extra.
This was the cherry on the top, that's all. But no, the whole thing was terrifying.
Yeah, sorry. Of course, live television dancing, because I've watched it so much, I forget that actually is probably also terrifying. But yeah, I wondered, because same thing, obviously very different scale, but since I've talked about it, so many people... talk to me about it, and I wondered if you'd had a similar thing of almost an slightly overwhelming of like people then suddenly come to you with their grief because somebody's opening a door. And again, it's a bit like you said about what we were talking about putting out the fires with her friends, of like, you seem someone who's willing to talk about it, and then people are drawn because they go, I know you're not going to burst into tears on me, and you're not going to go like, please stop talking, like, which is what we all fear we're going to do. So I think that gives people permission to talk to you, which it's wonderful, but also hard.
Yeah, but you've talked to the wonderful Catherine Mannix, haven't you?
The legend
that is Catherine. And Catherine's just written a new book called Listen.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Which I would urge everybody to read.
It's a fantastic book, yeah.
It's an extraordinary book about listening. Mm. That's all it is. And we all listen really badly.
I'm not great at it.
We're all rubbish. Because we're not listening to what anyone's saying, because we've got something to say and we're just waiting for a pause. Mm. And then we can say the thing that we wanted to say. And what's very clear when someone feels they know stuff about something and it will be helpful to the other person to just listen to what I feel about something, then we get into this terrible shtick. The person who approaches with whatever need or requirement, we have to be so gentle. Mm. And we have to just listen and see where they are willing to go to start with, to see what words they're willing to use to start with. Because it can feel like you're being beaten up if you're unable to use the D word or talk about the C word or all of this, and someone comes up, right, this is what you have to do, death, 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 cancer, 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 blah, blah, blah. And that's just complete nonsense, which is why it takes such a long time and requires few words, I think. And it was years ago, I went to the Festival of Death and Dying.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And they had Rose, what's her name? She was the chaplain in the House of Commons. Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous woman. And she was on stage talking about it. And she was talking about grief and what to do with a grieving person. Mm. And she said, well, they'll let you know what they want. Don't think we know what they want. Some people want a hug. Some people don't want to be touched. Some people want not to say anything. Some people want to talk. Some people are hungry.
Yeah.
All of these things. It is up to us to try and work out what they need at this moment rather than what we think they should have at this moment. And it's what I always say to everyone when anyone says, oh, God, what can I do? And I said, take them round some food.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. No one needs flowers.
The flowers people die. So
take them a roast chicken because they will have forgotten to eat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Again, it's the very difficult thing of feeling, because we're old hands at it, that we know what's appropriate and what you should be listening to now. No, just share a space with someone and see where they are. That's all.
Yeah, I think that's incredible advice. Obviously, take a vegan roast if they're vegan.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, take a vegan roast.
Although the smell might not have the same effect as a roast chicken will to me. If I smelt roast chicken, I'd be like, you know what? I think things are going to be okay. Even you describing roast chicken made me think, oh, God, I'd love a roast chicken. I mean, God, Greg, you're obviously doing incredible work in spreading that conversation. And it's just...
Yeah.
It's so important that that those who can have the conversation do.
For sure, and that we're having it in moments like this.
Oh God, yeah.
Where it's light and we can have a laugh.
And I'm
all the time banging on, you know, talk about this stuff in the pub with your mates, over a Sunday lunch, whatever else. Yeah. Bring it out of the shadows. Yeah. Because it's a necessary, it's an essential part of living a proper life. Is having an understanding that it is finite and that shit happens and that we will feel horrible from time to time and we can't inure ourselves. We have to embrace it because it makes us, as we've talked about it, as talked before about the whole kintsugi of it, it makes us the exquisitely broken and repaired beings that we are. And that's what's so wonderful about it. And of course, you can't think about that when you're in the midst of it all and you just are a bundle of snot and horror. But we have to be able to welcome it and not judge it and know that it is essential.
Oh, Greg, I think on that fantastic piece of advice and oratory, thank you so much for talking to me. And remembering Claire and your friend Simon as well, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It was such an honour to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, that's glorious, Carrie. Thank you very much.
Greg's book, Not That Kind of Love, which he wrote in collaboration with his sister Claire, is available to buy now. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. If you have been enjoying the show, please rate and review it. It helps other listeners find it. The show was edited by Kate Holland. It was recorded remotely. I'm still doing that in my living room and somewhere where Greg was at the time. Can't remember where he was. The music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, as ever, you're not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.